are listening to Teacher Toolkit, supporting teachers, parents and students worldwide.
I know parents expect homework and there's also that expectation, but I think you've got to be really clear what the aims are for that homework. And I think often there is homework set almost for the sake of it.
We help teachers thrive and survive with classroom ideas, cutting-edge school resources and research-informed teacher training materials. You will also hear discussions on the policy, guidance and research-based publications.
This week, listen to Ross McGill, founder of Teacher Toolkit, interview Lee Elliott Major, a professor of practice at the University of Exeter, and is thought to be the world's first professor of social mobility. In today's podcast, some of the things we'll be discussing are why and how evidence-informed research can be misinterpreted, the data-rich but evidence-poor culture schools can fall victim to, and Lee and Professor Steve Higgins' latest book, What Works.
So today I am with Lee Elliott Major. Lee, could you introduce yourself to listeners and tell everybody what you do?
So I am a professor of practice at the University of Exeter. I am the country's, we think actually, the world's first professor of social mobility.
Oh, right. So can you tell us, I want to explore that in great depth actually, but can we rewind to your own childhood, having watched a recent TED talk and your own story, but for listeners that don't know you, can you describe your own educational background?
So I come from West London. I come from a place called Feltham, which is very near Heathrow Airport. It's famous for its Young Offenders Institution.
Yes, it is, yeah.
And I left school. Well, I was still on the school's books, but I effectively stopped going to school about 15, 16, which always surprises people. My mum and dad split up, and I lived on my own in London on Social Security.
How old were you?
So I was 16. Okay. I have to be careful with this story because my friends tell me it gets bigger every year
right?
I have now a 16-year-old son. So when you're my age as a 51-year-old dad, you really reflect on these issues and look back on how it was. But yes, I lived on my own. I stopped going to lessons, and I eventually had to retake my A-levels at a college, further education college. Ended up then going to University of Sheffield to study physics. Did a PhD in theoretical physics, which I don't mention a part of, it stops the conversation dead. Then an education journalist. I worked at The Guardian. And then I went on to work at the Sutton Trust Education Foundation. And 6 months ago, I became a professor.
Yeah. So quite an interesting journey. In terms of teaching, or going back to when you were 16, was there any particular teacher that stood out or made a difference, or did that not happen for you?
There were many teachers that stood out for me, and they did all they could to try and keep me on track. There was just a lot going on in my life outside. And it's funny, actually, because now as an educationalist and someone who thinks about these issues a lot, one of the things that concerns me about schools is that we expect so much from them. And in a world where, you know, inequalities have got more and more extreme, I think we put too much on schools. And I guess that's reflected in my own experience when I look back on my life. But I actually was chosen for the Oxbridge stream at school. And knowing my family had ever been to university, and I do remember, I think it was the head of sixth form sort of helped me, coached me. I had to do extra Latin lessons, I remember. I think it was at the time when you had to do Latin to get into Oxford and Cambridge. So they helped me immensely. And I do have regrets and feel guilt in many ways, because at the end of the day, it was me who didn't turn up at school. But I retook my A-levels, and I always had a really good sort of feeling about schools, even though I effectively dropped out.
What made the difference for you then going on to university and then the MA and then the PhD? There must have been someone along the way.
You know, it's funny, there's a bit of me that there was always people, you know, that supported me. And one of the themes in the TEDx talk I talk about is when we look back on success, if we're judged a success, usually it's a collective endeavour. Usually you look back and there's loads of people There was an uncle, long passed away now, bless him, who paid for me to go to mm-hmm. do a master's course. Mm-hmm. There were people, lecturers and teachers who helped me along the way, but I was quite persistent. My mum used to tell the story of when I turned up at primary school the first day, I would hassle the teacher, I would follow the teacher around asking all these questions. So there was clearly something there. Mm-hmm. But in my view, when we look back on ourselves, usually it's a whole bunch of people that have helped us through our lives, and that's certainly the case for me.
And so at no point did teaching ever come up as a career path?
I was always interested in teaching, but I did that at university. So I taught as a postgraduate. It's funny, and I still have this. So when I speak with teachers, when we first, we'll come on to this, but when I first produced the toolkit, the Sutton Trust to get a toolkit, I used to always stand up in front of teachers and say, look, just so you all know, I've never actually properly taught in a classroom, but I'm going to tell you what to do. And I was trying to be upfront about that fact and say, look, I'm coming from a sort of research perspective on this. But I still, to this day, dream that I will do some teaching. And I hope, actually, as maybe part of a new role, that I have time to do that. So it still remains a sort of aspiration, but I'm a sort of secret teacher.
Yeah, okay. Now, your work with the Sutton Trust, what date did you start that, just for context?
So it was 2006 that I started the Trust.
And when did the Teaching Toolkit come out?
So that was 2011. So that's something that happened when the coalition government, seems like a long time ago now, doesn't it? Mm. When the coalition government came out, they had this policy, which was the pupil premium policy, mm-hmm. extra money for disadvantaged pupils. And our response was, look, that's really good mm-hmm. in principle, although in reality, of course, it wasn't extra money. It was sort of money within the same budget. But our response was a simple one, was, look, it's not how much you spend, it's not how much you spend, it's the way you spend it that counts.
Mm, okay.
And that became known as the Bananarama principle.
Yes.
For listeners who remember the Bananarama 1980s song, it's not what you do, it's the way you do it.
Yeah.
And, well, we might come back to that, because that's absolutely key in everything that we've done through the toolkit. So we were looking really for someone, an academic, mm-hmm. to help us come up with a sort of synthesis, a summary of education research to say how should teachers be helped to decide how to spend this money.
Mm-hmm.
And I met Professor Steve Higgins. It was like a sort of love story, really. I sort of saw him over at a seminar. He was presenting on John Hattie's work.
Right.
And I went up to him, this is probably 2010, and I said to him, look, I'd love to work with you on a guide for mm-hmm. teachers for this new pupil premium. And from then, we've now become very good friends. The toolkit emerged. Really,
yeah,
from
yeah.
That
so, I mean, on my training travels, I always share the EEF, and it's a quick win for teachers to at least access some research-informed strategies. I'm still surprised how the audiences I meet, that often some people still don't know about it.
Yeah.
But I'm safe to say that a lot of school leaders do, so I would imagine many teachers are in safe hands. What are the headlines of the toolkit in terms of how best to use it, and what are potential warnings, so look beyond the headlines, so to speak?
So the toolkit, I think, is reassuring for many teachers in that it confirms some of the best instincts I think that teachers would have, and that is that the things that work best are all related to teacher-pupil interaction. So it's not about what name you give the school, what structure you give the school. It always comes back to the classroom. And so, for example, effective feedback in the toolkit comes up as a very cost-effective approach, although it's very hard to do. Peer-to-peer tutoring comes up very highly. What we call metacognition, thinking or learning, comes up very highly. So it's the things that relate to the teacher-pupil interaction. The challenge with that, and it's something we talk about in our What Works book that's coming out next month, is that the Bananarama principle, i.e. how you do it, applies very much for those areas. So, you know, it's very easy. And in the early days, I remember representatives saying, oh, look, all you have to do is effective feedback. Now, of course, behind that is huge nuances around how timely is the feedback, what messaging you bring that. And I got obsessed, actually, with feedback. And what you find is the research can only take you so far. So I'm very proud to be a part of the evidence-led movement in evidence-informed movement in teaching, but I think sometimes I worry that it's interpreted too far, in that we always said it was about giving best bets to professional practitioners to decide what they do in the classroom. Mm-hmm. I think in some circles it got interpreted as here's the sort of silver bullets.
Mm-hmm. There's lots of caution with effect sizes and their interpretation. I spoke to someone earlier today about, is it called effectiveness research? What would be your advice? So I'm a school leader, I'm looking on the toolkit and I see metacognition has a 7+ month impact. What would be your warning for, or what would be your advice for me to, again, it's not what you do, it's how you do it. What would you recommend?
So let's just take teaching assistants as an easier example. What we found was, and it was a very famous headline finding at the time, and I remember presenting to 200 TAs in Cambridgeshire on the last day of
term. Read about this in your book, yeah.
And and basically the average finding was that there was zero impact on attainment using teaching assistants. Now, what we were not saying categorically was that you should sack your TAs. Mm-hmm. If you look behind that finding, what you find is that there are some brilliant TAs doing brilliant work, but they'd been trained well, they'd been prepared well, and the teachers were working with them well. So again, it came back down to how TAs were being deployed. Mm-hmm. And that's behind all these headlines, is really the nuances are more complex than the headlines would make you believe. So on ability setting versus mixed ability, you know, people often ask me what you should do. If you look at all the research papers on this, what they really say is it's the quality of teaching that matters more than whether you set by ability or not. Mm-hmm. So you can set by ability, but only if you do it really well. You have flexibility of children in terms of moving up and down the sets. I do worry about setting by ability, because a lot of schools I visit that do it still do it, in my opinion, in a very rigid way. So you tend to think of certain pupils as having lots of ability, and I would... And they tend to get stuck, if you like, in those sets. And what we know is that disadvantaged pupils, on average, even if they've got the same capability as their more privileged peers, tend to end up in the lower sets. If you look at the fine print of the toolkit, we would say that put your best, inverted commas, teachers in the lower sets, actually.
Right.
And the more I've looked at this, the more I would actually... invest more in disadvantaged pupils than less. You know, in the 10 years or so since we first developed the toolkit, I've observed even a bigger inequality in education. So if you look at the amount of private tutoring that goes on outside schools, which is fueled mainly by the middle classes, in my view, I feel like we should be investing, one, more in schools generally, but a higher proportion for me would go towards disadvantaged pupils.
Yeah, I think another byproduct is you often see performance-related pay fueling heads of department who will choose the best classes so they get an easier appraisal, whereas their new teachers left with the bottom sets, which isn't good for anyone. So with your Sutton Trust going back, if I could go back throughout the decade, what would probably... I guess the question is, what would you like to see change? And I would imagine this is in your book, and we'll talk about that shortly, but what's the key thing you'd like to see change in at least state school education in England?
Right now.
Based on what you've discovered through the EEF.
So, wow, it's a good question. I mean, I think in the new book, What Works, the thing that I've realised more and more is that we need wider outcomes to measure children. And if you look at the toolkit when we produced it, and there was all sorts of good reasons, because the government money we got for the Education Endowment Foundation was really about raising attainment. That was the deal, if you like. I have now a much, I suppose, wider view in terms of what we should focus on for our children's development. So that means thinking about, you know, self-esteem, confidence, self-regulation, all these terms. Essentially, it's the other bits. It's the social skills, it's the life skills. It's the arts and sports. Mm-hmm. I worry that the obsession with attainment has actually narrowed the curriculum down to such an extent that many of the poorest pupils aren't getting all that other stuff, which is so crucial, we know, for their
lives. That cultural capital, isn't it, that seems to be narrowed the buzz.
It depends what you define as cultural capital.
Yes, absolutely.
Capital. I think wider outcomes, I'd say. I mean, the other thing I would say is really the evidence-informed movement and the toolkit particularly. What really they were about was the primacy of teachers and teaching, really. Mm-hmm. And the reason that I keep going on about that was it was always meant to empower teachers to use best bets, mm-hmm. and then for them to decide. I think sometimes it's been abused as a sort of almost a national sort of diktat of what teachers
should do. And so where do you see teacher action research in their own classroom having a place and being valid and also heard?
Yeah.
So, or credible as well.
So the Education Doubt Foundation, and I was a big part of this, you know, we instigated the first really randomised controlled trials in education in this country. Mm-hmm. I think there was probably one randomised controlled trial before the EF, and there's now over 100. Mm-hmm. So these are very rigorous trials where, you know, you randomise the treatment you give. It's a bit like the medical model. Right. I think, you know, there's still a need for those studies, but what I've learned, really, again, as a professor now, I'm a mixed methods man, you know, so I think that there are many valid ways of doing research, mm-hmm. and actually action research informed by some of the literature from randomised trials, mm-hmm. can be very powerful. One of the problems of randomised trials is that if you just look at the impact of does it work or doesn't it work, you're left also always with the question, so why didn't it work or why did it work? And I think... Yeah. The more qualitative side of research is equally important. So I'm very much a sort of mixed method person, mm-hmm. and I think some of the academic debates that you get, you know, you get the sort of randomised trials camp versus the sort of qualitative camp can be really destructive, actually. Mm-hmm. For me, it's about both, but you do need both, in my view.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've argued that with a progressive and traditional debate as an example. Yeah, exactly. You see that on social media quite a lot also. So I'm assuming you've visited many schools, colleges, universities on your travels with the EEF, and you'd be fully aware that workload continues to blight teachers. Have you got any words of wisdom or quick tips or any insights into what you understand to be... Has it always been there? Is it new? Is it ed tech? Is it AI? What's driving teachers? Or is it lack of funding? What seems to be blighting our profession in terms of recruitment and workload?
So, in my view, part of the issue is the expectations put on teachers. And I relate to this, you know, as someone in the education world. You know, we can always do more because we're all passionate, mm-hmm. about particularly improving outcomes for the most disadvantaged young people. And the problem is, of course, that the actual money for schools has gone down in real terms. So I think, in a way, the expectations has gone up because... there have been so many cuts in other areas of public services. So I think part of the thing driving workload is the huge passion in the profession to do as well as they can, and the escalating, mm-hmm. expectations alongside that. I think in terms of in the book What Works, we do a sort of workload test where we sort of urge teachers to think really hard about, is this an essential activity that will impact on teaching and learning in the classroom? Mm-hmm. How cost-effective is it in terms of time compared to other things you're doing? You know, is it really worth doing? And so we have this test, and a few ideas that come out of that, and you've spoken a lot about this as well, is one is marking. So if you look at the evidence around marking, really it's about focus. It's about giving feedback on major misconceptions, maybe, in a paper, rather than trying to comprehensively look at every single point. homework, incidentally, at primary school, on average, has very little effect. So I think, again, for me, being really strict on yourself in terms of why are you doing this homework. So I know parents expect homework, and there's always that expectation, but I think you've got to be really clear what the aims are for that homework. And I think often there is homework set almost for the sake of it. So I think focus in terms of marking.
So do you think that's a teacher habit or a parental perception?
It's a parental perception. I think also, unwittingly, we were part of the problem in many ways, because we came up with the findings, you know, that were quite influential, I think, in terms of Ofsted. You know, that effective feedback was really important. That kind of got interpreted in a way of more marking.
Right. More.
So the thing about research is you do get unintended consequences, and what we're realising, you know, I guess I was a bit more naive 10 years ago. You know, you produce the research report, the teachers, every teacher says, oh, yeah, of course we should do it this way. What you find is actually you need people to talk with teachers, I think, face-to-face, actually, ideally, and explain what the research is and what the nuances are. Mm-hmm. And when we talk about effective feedback, we're not actually talking about more and more marking.
Okay.
I think also there has been what I would call a data-rich but evidence-poor culture in some schools. So I'm a school governor of a few schools, and often even me, with all my sort of knowledge, I get befuddled by these huge data spreadsheets, you know, trying to analyse where we are as a school.
Yes.
And what you want, of course, is a synthesis of that with some key points from it. And I think
A one-pager.
And actually, as a governor, I have influenced, and one thing I haven't is that I get now an exec summary with 3 points for every report. So I think all these things are well-intentioned, but they add time to what you do. And now, as a professor, I think really hard about how I work. I think we can all be more work efficient, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say that I think that schools are under-resourced, and we might come onto this, but I think when I visit schools, it's amazing what we're doing, you know, but some schools are now providing breakfast.
Yeah, I think, you know, the time poor issue, which will always be prevalent, often might lead to me interpreting the research poorly because I have no time to access it thoroughly. Tell me more about the book.
So What Works is a book, I guess, 8 years after we produced the original toolkit. And I should emphasise the toolkit is freely available for all teachers, but the What Works book is a sort of additional resource that, one, it sort of tries to look at the sort of teacher tips and the school leadership tips for 21 school approaches. And we'd really try to synthesise the research to give a practical guidance for teachers. And it looks at not just attainment, but broader outcomes for those for those areas. And the Bananarama principle is a theme throughout the book, which is, as I keep on going on about, it's not what you do, it's the
I'm
way you
do. Showing your
people.
Age here.
I know. But that, you know, that is a theme. And interestingly, when we wrote the introduction to the book, people might be surprised by this, but we talk about the limits of research as well as the power of research in helping teachers do what they do. There's a really interesting debate at the moment, because what the EEF has done is done all these randomised trials. What we found that when you go from a small pilot using maybe 10 schools to an effectiveness trial which has hundreds of schools, you see the relative impact or effect size shrink.
Right.
And what we think is behind that, and there's many theories, is it's just the amount of support you're giving to teachers to implement the programme. So in my view, the implementation of a programme is as important as the content. So one-to-one tutoring, for example, we've trialled loads of different one-to-one tutoring programmes. Effectively, what we found is that one-to-one tutoring, or one-to-two, one-to-three tutoring, is very powerful, and in a way, you know, the exact program you use it doesn't make that much difference.
In your book, do you discuss the kind of tutoring market?
Yeah.
often by a non-DBS or perhaps unqualified teacher. I'm just looking through the list. You've got in your book, you've got peer tutoring, mastery learning, learning styles, homework we've discussed. If I can pick out Summer Born Disadvantage, what are the headlines from that particular chapter?
So I'm an August-born child, so is my son, so I have a bias in this area. But I think that there is a real, if you like, black spot in terms of how we think of disadvantage, and that is what we call summer-born disadvantage in the book. Mm-hmm. And that is that children born in summer, say June to August, essentially are just a bit younger, particularly in the primary school years. Mm-hmm. So they tend not to be picked for the sport,
yeah.
But also they're not grouped for the higher attainers. And what the evidence shows is that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. So they end up with lower attainment on average than their older peers. And what you see is this plays out right through the education system. So August born are less likely to go to university, less likely to do well in GCSEs. I think teachers need to think about, I know there's a lot on their plate, but need to think explicitly about how they enable those from some children who are summer born to make sure that they are picked for things in a way that they would treat
others. I've recently discovered a bit of research. I mean, it sounds pretty obvious now, but where the schools might analyse their data by students' month that they are born, and I think the research I initially saw was it was very clear if you're September born, you're on average progress is significantly higher than August.
Yeah. It's basically down to the fact that they're just less mature, particularly at an earlier age. And I've seen this in many schools, that when you look at the school football team or something, and you look at the age, they're all September, October.
They are, yeah.
I think there's a real issue with sixth form selection at the moment. So in North London, where I'm from, there's essentially, I mean, we have always debates about selection in the States. In North London, at least, it happens. And there is still a summer-born effect at age 16. So if you're summer-born, you're basically less likely to get into one of the, inverted commas, more selective.
I was November-born. I managed to get... Well, I started in the second team at university.
Right,
Gradually worked my way up to the first. But, it's very interesting point.
Yeah.
Right, I'm going to finish off with some quick-fire questions.
Right.
So I want your immediate thoughts.
Okay, wow.
So you just mentioned you just moved into a kind of new world of kind of semi-freelance stroke balancing the challenges. So what are you currently working on at the moment?
So I've got a number of projects. I am very interested in the forgotten third, number of pupils who are essentially failed. They're given one, two or three in the current grading system for GCSEs. I want to know more about these children. I've got a few sort of proposals to do this. I actually want to interview some. You know, we never hear the voices of young people. So who are they? And I want to critique the system. I mean, this is something we've been thinking about for years. Mm-hmm. I think the current system is flawed. I think we need some sort of passport or threshold qualification that all children should pass. I also think we need a sort of diversity of options, so it's not just about the academic route. I know people find this funny as a PhD, I would say, but actually, for me, we are still obsessed with the academic side of the curriculum, and that essentially labels a significant number of our young children as failures, and I think that's wrong.
Okay. Fiction, what book are you reading at the moment, if you got one?
So I tend to read non-fiction. I'm very interested in the latest Malcolm Gladwell book.
Okay.
I think it's called Talking with Strangers.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
He writes incredibly well. So one of the things I've always wanted to do was to take complex findings and write accessibly for them. He does it brilliantly. But sometimes he is a bit thin with the truth sometimes. but I think there's a real skill that's underestimated in academe, which is synthesizing research. One of the books that I really liked, I'm trying to think of the name now, it was it'll come back to me. It's the Nobel Prize winner, The Economist, and it was all about our biases. Do you know,
Caldini?
No, this is
I will quote it in the blog, or we'll mention it later.
What's his name? Yeah, you know, it's all about our cognitive biases, and I found that fascinating. It's the Nobel Prize winner. You'll know it, but anyway.
Right, okay. We'll get it in an email, and we'll put it on the site. What would be your one piece of advice for a teacher who wanted to start their journey with research in the classroom?
Of course, I would say buy what works, the book. It is a very good summary, I believe, and an objective, authoritative summary of the research. Yeah, I would say that. I think, you know, I wouldn't necessarily, I mean, I still struggle going through academic papers. You know, yes. I'm not sure, personally, whether that's the best time for a teacher, actually.
Okay. If you didn't follow your journey into kind of EEF stroke PhD life, what would you have done instead? Dream job?
Maybe I'd have been a teacher or lecturer.
Okay, great. Who would you recommend I interview next and why?
Maybe it would be one of those pupils in Forgotten Third, actually, because I know you do some great interviews with people that I admire, but I just feel sometimes the voices of the pupils that we are currently failing, and I say we as a collective here.
Yeah, okay.
I'd be really interested to know what their views
Final
are.
Final student, okay. That's a great one. I'll try and make sure that I do that soon. Where can listeners find out more about you? Website, blog, book plug again, Twitter?
So I'm on Twitter. I have a very small website, sort of presence on the University of Exeter's website. The easiest is probably Twitter or LinkedIn for me, but yeah.
Okay, and the book's called?
What Works.
When's it out?
The 3rd of October.
And how many pennies?
I don't even know. It's very cheap, I think. It's under £10.
Right, fantastic. Yeah. Right, it's been a pleasure to talk to you, Lee. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Keep up the amazing work.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To continue the conversation, head over to www.teachertoolkit.co.uk and our social media channels to access all the links and resources mentioned on today's show. Why not share this with your colleagues and give them the gift of time, reduced workload, and increased impact? Until the next time, before you look after your students, look after yourself.